This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news, on Newsstand Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to WNRN and the Sunday morning wake-up call. Folks from 91.9 to Richmond's 103.1, we appreciate you being here with us on a beautiful Sunday. We are going to be talking politics today. I know the election was this past Tuesday. We didn't discuss politics in great detail on Sunday because I wanted to wait for the post-election discussion. What did happen? Not polls about what might happen. Our guest today, Professor Sidney Milkus. How are you today, Professor?
I'm good, Rick. How are you?
I'm well. It's a beautiful day. Thank you for taking your time to be here.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I loved your comment out in the lobby about if I'd only known what the weather was going to be.
I have to get a better weather forecast from now on, Rick, before I agree to come on here.
Professor Milkus, UVA's Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics, also involved at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia.
Indeed.
Quite a long list of earned rights and titles for you.
Yes, almost aristocratic, don't you think?
Well, you know, when you start getting to professors who've been around the UVA for a while, I think aristocracy starts to be attached to you. We are going to be talking about what happened on this past Tuesday, the election. Professor Milkus with us about a year ago, I guess, your recently released title at the time about Theodore Roosevelt, 1912.
Right. Yep, yeah.
And you commented about how it's been 100 years.
100 years, yeah.
And I want to get into that a little bit, but let me start. Certainly the election, depending on who you talk to, could have gone either way.
Mm-hmm.
To Governor Romney or President Obama, what I found most interesting was that Governor Romney, during his entire time, didn't seem to be any discussion that was had, whether it was a debate, whether it was TV time, radio time, it always came back to jobs for Governor Romney. And with the outcome of the election, does that show that the election wasn't all about finances, that it was as much about social issues?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And to be honest, Rick, I'm still digesting what the election was all about. But I think it certainly was about the economy. I think the exit poll showed most people cared about things like jobs and, interestingly, inflation. But social issues were also extremely important. Immigration was a huge issue and maybe the decisive factor in the election. The issue of race, because of the voter ID laws passed in the various states, were extremely important as well. And of course, women's issues were extremely important. And although Governor Romney had tried to focus like a laser on jobs during the general election, during the primaries, he took positions, particularly on immigration, that echoed into the general election, I think, hurt him very badly in the results of last Tuesday.
That leads me to a question I had on here about primaries. Is the primary method going to change? Because with the Republicans this past year, there were, I don't even know anymore, 8, 10, 12 initial nominees. And then it took quite some time to wind down to even the last 3 or 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. And in that current system, you have to badmouth the person across from you. You say things that, while they might be in some way true, they're still negative about a member of your own party. And then it comes around to when it's just one-on-one that you've given to the other side, the other party, negative things to throw back at the candidate.
You know, that's a great point, and it's fascinated me historically to watch the development of the nomination system. You know, back in the beginning of the 20th century, an era I've really been interested in, the the nominees for the presidency were selected by the conventions, delegates who came to the conventions who represented the state and local party organizations, and they deliberated and sometimes cut deals to nominate candidates, but it wasn't this food fight that we see with the primary system, which really begins at the turn of the 20th century. 1912 is the first election where you have a presidential primary contest, and Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft carved each other up in that election. Woodrow Wilson won the general election. But it comes into fruition in the 1970s. And it was designed to establish a more democratic process, to take it away from the boys in the smoke-filled rooms. And so, and it has, one can argue, Rick, it is more democratic, but as you say, the parties pay a severe cost for this democracy, because the nomination contests weaken them in such important ways. It wasn't, we hear a lot about President Obama and his ads attacked Governor Romney and destroyed his reputation that he had to try to restore during the fall. All these ads attacked him in the summer as a vicious capitalist. Well, it was Newt Gingrich during the primaries, as you were suggesting, Rick, who first attacked Governor Romney as a vicious capitalist who took jobs away from people. And so it was the Republicans themselves who set the stage for much of the Democratic campaign during the summer of 2012.
Again, we are talking with Professor Sidney Milkus, UVA's Department of Politics, here on WNRN's Sunday morning wake-up call. Professor, so do you see in the future, look forward, Prophet, and tell us, is there going to be any change in this primary system? Because you would think that this, it may have started in the 70s, but this most recent one from the Republican Party, where it extended so long that excessive amounts of money were spent before and used even before Governor Romney became the official nominee. And then, as you said, all from the food fight, that all the negativity that came from within, will someone take this back to the past or invent a new method of finding the nominee?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot, and I have this metaphor, Rick, that it's hard to put the toothpaste back into the tube. So once we get some kind of reform like the direct primary, which at least seems to give the voters greater choice in a society that believes in we the people and popular sovereignty, it's very hard to go back to a situation, even though it may be better for democracy in the eyes of a professor or an intelligent radio program interviewer, to restore some of that authority to the party organization, so that the nomination fights are less a matter of personal destruction and more a matter of trying to find a candidate who somehow is going to represent the party well in the general election. Even though all that makes sense, it's hard for me to envision a political scenario in which we're going to go back to a situation where the party organizations have this power. So I think your question about, are there new ways to restore some of the deliberation or compromises that were part of the old system, is a really a good question. In Virginia, there is the option of having a convention system, and sometimes that's used rather than a primary. If a certain number of members within the party organization vote not to have a primary, we don't have one, and there's a possibility that there could be a restoration of some of the old methods that would restore a bit of civility. Is probably too strong a word, but take away some of the worst features of the food fight. One thing that might help, one of the differences, Rick, between a general election and a primary is the turnout in the primaries are relatively small compared to the general election. So 30% of the eligible voters is a good turnout. In a primary election, we had, I think, 57% of the eligible electorate voted in the general election. So, if it's not just the democracy of the primaries that causes the destructive personal destruction that characterizes them. It is also the fact that the people who vote in them tend to be the party loyalists, the base, which leads to a more destructive kind of contest. So if the parties, organizations could do a better job of getting a larger turnout in their primary so you get more of a representative electorate, that perhaps would be a helpful thing for the contests.
We're talking post-election politics with UVA Professor Sidney Milkus. Professor, I want to get into sort of the election itself, but just to follow up on that, do you think that there might be some written or unspoken rules going forward in primaries where the base says you can't badmouth your candidate, you can only promote yourself?
That's a really optimistic view, Rick. And
I have that.
And I respect that, and I want your mom to be happy. I think there probably will be some discussion about that. You know, in 2016, we're going to have a lot of fun, Rick, because, of course, President Obama won't be able to run for re-election again. And so we're going to have open contest in both parties. And so we'll have not only a lot going on within the Republican Party next time, but an open battle in the Democratic Party as well. So we could have a more exciting contest or one that would be more aggravating for your mom in 2016. So there may be some discussion within the party councils about let's calm down. Let's not attack each other during these primary contests. Let's save that for the general election. I remember Ronald Reagan was always fond of saying I think it was the 11th Amendment is thou shalt not attack another Republican. and that kind of preaching may be going on, but boy, that's a hard thing to enforce, Rick, because essentially these are candidate-centered campaigns that the candidates really design themselves. And also, don't forget that we now have this spending regimen in place with these super PACs, which can give people a ton of money to sustain a campaign that may not be that popular, but supports a cause that a rich donor wants to see go forward. And that, again, is a very difficult thing to control. So somebody like Newt Gingrich was financed by a super PAC that allowed him to, I think, do great damage to Governor Romney during the campaign. Without those super PACs or without that kind of campaign finance regimen, he may not have been able to sustain that kind of campaign.
So let's go back to the results from Tuesday. And I asked if this election had proven to be more about social issues than financial issues. How does, if the campaign isn't formidably about financial issues, how does President Obama win when he wins the state of Nevada? Was it 11% unemployment in the state of Nevada?
And terrible housing market, yeah.
And you can pick and choose from other states that President Obama happened to win, or that, and again, I go back to Governor Romney, jobs, jobs, jobs. That was his focus, what I felt to be his focus throughout the campaign. And even with such a large percentage of unemployment throughout the nation, not just in Nevada, President Obama wins re-election.
Yeah. I would point to a couple things. One, having to do with economic and social issues. I think economic issues were extremely important, but two things helped, I think, President Obama win a small but, I think, a decisive victory. One is enough people thought, Rick, that the economy was moving in the right direction. So it may seem kind of silly if you really figure out the numbers, but the fact that unemployment went from below 8% right before the general election, I think that helped President Obama a lot. So the difference between 8% and 7.9% may not seem so significant to you and me or people who are unemployed, but for some reason that number has always been significant in American politics. The other thing I'd point to in terms of the economy is that people tended to blame President Bush and the Republicans more than they tended to blame President Obama and the Democrats for the struggles, economic struggles we were having. And the hole was so deep when President Obama became president that it wasn't surprising that it was taking time to get out of this economic morass. And then the third thing to note economically is that when people thought about the economy, they said in a slight percentage advantage for Governor Romney that he would handle the economy better. but they felt that President Obama understood their problems better. They felt more empathy from President Obama. And so those three things together, in spite of, I agree with your premise that the fundamentals were not good for President Obama, and the Republicans had a chance to win. But those three economic issues contributed to President Obama's ability to win a close election. If I could just mention one social issue, because you're right to say they were very important, and you pointed to Nevada. I think, you know, I've been saying for years that the party that wins the Hispanic vote will control the future of American politics, because they are the fastest growing population. I think they constitute about 16% of the American population right now. And again, as I mentioned before, because Governor Romney took such a conservative and really, Rick, harsh position on immigration during the primaries, in part to attack people like Governor Rick Perry, who had taken a more supportive position of the children of immigrant families. Because he had taken that hard position, it really haunted him in the general election. And President Obama won 70% of the Hispanic vote. I haven't run the numbers, Rick, and I'm not a quantitative guy, but I think if Governor Romney had won 44% of the Latino vote, as George W. Bush won in 2004, taking a much more progressive position on immigration, he may have won this election, and he certainly would have won Nevada, I think.
One of the things you talk about, the Latino vote, Hispanics in Nevada, one of the points of conversation that I found most interesting in this post-election conversation all around the country was the method that each candidate used to connect. You used the word empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Was that President Obama chose a different way of reaching out to potential voters, because he went on to Letterman and Jon Stewart and Jay Leno, mm-hmm. and that he went at midnight in Nevada to meet with the food service union, or whatever the proper term is for that group, because he knew that if he went from 8 to 5, that they were going to be busy. If you go for the big table meeting, you know, where you have all your supporters in, those are the folks who are servicing that group of people. And he made a point to go and reach the public in ways that they gather their information from Leno and Letterman and Jay Stewart, and to meet them during their what little free time people have, the off hours. Do you find that to be am I right in thinking that there was a difference, that I missed something that Governor Romney might have been doing that I'm overlooking?
Yeah, it's a fun question to think about, these kind of cultural influences on elections the likability factor, Rick, and I think it's definitely true that the country liked President Obama better than they liked President Romney. Although towards the end, Romney made great strides in his favorability factors, as pollsters say. But I think the empathy factor, in part, did come from the fact that President Obama seemed a little more in tune with the reality, as some of my colleagues say, the reality of the demographics of the country now. He certainly seemed to better suited to represent the more diverse country we are now. 20 years ago, I think 89% of the electorate was non-Hispanic whites. I think this time, Rick, maybe somebody out there will correct me, but I think it was about 72%. Of the electorate was non-Hispanic whites, and President Obama, in the way he campaigns, of course, and in the fact that he's the first African American president, seems really better suited than Mitt Romney was to represent this more diverse country. And also, just your point about going on TV and stuff like that. You know, Bill Clinton was kind of a cool president. Remember him playing his saxophone? Was that the Arsenio Hall show? Remember that?
I do remember. Yeah. I couldn't remember to tell you when, but yes.
Yeah, I think it was the Arsenio Hall show.
Playing his saxophone.
Remember that? Remember that? The impact that had?
Yes.
And hence connecting with young voters was particularly important. Well, President Obama connects with young voters because he is a cool president. He may be the coolest president we've ever had in plays basketball and stuff like that. And, you know, when President Obama did so well with the young voters in 2008 and got them out, and it's hard to get young people out to
vote.
And
the understanding was that wasn't going to happen again this time.
It wasn't going to happen again because, you know, young people, they have other stuff to do besides politics. They're not like you. Right. They're not like junkies like you. And
this election wasn't as cool as that one.
Right.
That one was all about hope.
That one,
and this one, we lost our hope. Yeah, and so the expectation was, not going to happen. No need to worry about it.
But it happened again. Now, President Obama didn't win the youth vote by as substantial margins as he did, but he still won an overwhelming, I think it was 59% of people under 30. So the fact that it's happened twice shows that this connection you're talking about, combination of policies, but I do think it has to do with the personality of Barack Obama, has really been a significant factor for the last 8 years.
11:20 here on the Wake Up Call. We're talking post-election politics with our guest, Professor Sidney Milkus. He's from UVA's Woodrow Wilson Department of Politics. Call up, ask your question, make your comment to Professor Milkus. 979-0919-877-967-6762. That's 877-WNRN-ROCKS. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Sunny and breezy today, highs in the upper 60s, lower 70s in Lynchburg and Richmond. Cloudy with a little bit of wind tonight in the mid-40s, and then mostly cloudy with a 20% chance of rain tomorrow. Highs again in the mid-60s, a little warmer in Richmond. Right now, sunny day outside, 64 in the valley, 58 in Lynchburg, 57 in Richmond, 52 here in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
Professor Milk is making me laugh. Support for WNRN today comes from L. Oppelman, serving Lynchburg for 122 years. In addition to loans, L. Oppelman deals in jewelry, musical instruments, rifles, handguns and game systems, plus TVs, cameras, and tools. They have new inventory arriving every day. This holiday season, you can take advantage of L. Oppelman's layaway plan and get a head start on your Christmas list. That's L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street, downtown Lynchburg. All right, phone lines are open if you want to call in, ask a question, make a comment to Professor Milkus. Maybe just let your voice be heard, 979-0919. Toll free, it's 877-WNRN-ROCKS. Professor, there were certainly, no matter who you wanted to win, who you voted for, there were certainly lots of things thrown out there as to possible issues affecting the final outcome. My personal favorite as either a push or an excuse, whichever, was Hurricane Sandy.
Mm.
Do you really think that played a role in maybe causing some people not to vote or giving the – what were some of the others? Oh, shutting down the Romney campaign for 3 days out of niceness, to what's going on, or giving President Obama the chance to go show his authority. Do you think that really had a play?
It's a fascinating question, and I haven't seen kind of tracking polls that would put a fine point on the answer to your question, Rick. But I think it did have a very important influence on the election. You know, we always in the biz we always talk about the possibility of an October surprise. Well, Sandy, in a sense, was the October surprise, and I think it was important in two ways. One, which didn't affect the election, is that the turnout, I noticed, was lower in this election than it was in 2004 and 2008. So it had gone up there during those two elections to over 60% of the eligible voters. I think it went down to about 57% this time. That surprised me because my sense was people were really engaged in this election. They thought it was really important. And I don't know if that how much of that came from the difficulty of voting in places like heavily populated states like New York and New Jersey. So that's one effect it may have had. And so we should be careful about reading the turnout figures and saying, well, people weren't as into this election as they were in 2008. But I think the way it might have affected the election is, as we all remember, after the first debate, it did seem like President. I keep calling him President, and it's not. It's because it's Sunday morning. It's not. It's not a kind of Freudian slip. Governor Romney gained some considerable momentum after the first debate, and some of that. And some of those likability factors started to change significantly. We were talking about before, Rick. And some of that changed in the second and third debate, where clearly President Obama did a whole lot better. But there was still some feeling that the momentum was on Governor Romney's side, or at least there was still a chance he could sneak over in that last week. But I think any chance of that was really disrupted, using my term advisedly, by Sandy. And, you know, disaster relief. Our society, Rick, is so polarized in a partisan sense that when the president is engaged in disaster relief, and the president seems to do that, that's one thing that can rise in our contemporary partisan rancorous society that can rise above partisan conflict. And I thought the fact that Chris Christie, who perhaps other than Marco Rubio is the most popular guy in the Republican Party right now, was walking arm in arm with President Obama and praised his efforts as excellent. I definitely think that helped President Obama, made him look very presidential, got him, he heard a nice thing from Governor Romney's strongest supporters. And I don't know if it was a decisive factor in the election, but I think it probably at least ensured that that President Obama would win a majority of the popular vote.
11:26 on WNRN's Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Thanks for being with us. I'm Rick Moore, our guest today. Professor Sidney Milk is from UVA's Department of Politics. Professor, we've touched here and touched there about Hispanic vote. We haven't gotten into the gender gap yet, and I want to get into that in just a moment. Yeah. But some of the conversation that has come about afterwards for all these potential lost spots were Governor Romney, if he'd only gotten this percentage rather than this percentage, and that the old manner in which the Republican Party looked at the vote, that has been one of the issues, is they need to modernize. They need to meet their, it's not all about the white shirt and the blue jacket with the red tie anymore. Do you think that Republicans need to modernize the way that they envision their voters?
Yeah. You know, that question, it's dangerous to ask an academic whether a party should modernize, because we argue about what modernity means all the time. And you and I don't want to get into that. But
and you, as a professor who writes about the history of politics.
Right. So I think the Republican Party needs to address the changing demographics of the country. Any political party has to be sensitive to these kind of changes. And I think that they have been greatly damaged by taking such a harsh position on immigration, opposing things like the DREAM Act. I think one of the key moments of the election was in June 2012 when, because the Congress would not act on the DREAM Act, which opens up paths of citizenship for children that were brought to the United States.
Children who were born in the United States but whose parents are not legal citizens.
Well, the DREAM Act affects people, children who were brought to the United States by their parents as children. And so they are in risk of deportation, or they were at risk for deportation until President Obama issued the executive order that kind of carried out the DREAM Act administratively, so that he protected this population from deportation and established avenues of citizenship for that group. And the reason he did that, he said, was because the Congress refused to act on the DREAM Act and the Republicans had obstructed it. I think that was that issuance of the DREAM Act rule was a key moment in this election, because Hispanics weren't too happy with President Obama until that point either. And there he really established the difference between the parties. So one of the things Republicans have been talking about extensively over the last few days is to support things like the DREAM Act to establish this as legislatively, and also to work with President Obama to establish some kind of comprehensive immigration reform that would be a combination of border security and opening up additional avenues of citizenship for illegal immigrants in the United States. I've even heard a couple of Republican leaders use the term amnesty in the last few days. So,
and they're still Republicans.
And they're still, well, when I came in here this morning, they hadn't been thrown out of the party. So one thing the Republicans are addressing is their position on immigration. And I think talking about this question of modernity, I think that one of the things the Republican Party might think about doing is returning to their roots, which is individual freedom. Establishing borders with electric fences is not often viewed as individual freedom, liberty in this country. An open policy towards immigration has a tremendously important tradition in our country. And I think the Republican Party, as a conservative party, not a modern party in the Democratic sense, could certainly take a progressive position on immigration that would benefit them politically and I think would be right in terms of principles.
Professor Sidney Milk is here on the Wake Up Call here at WNRN. We have a caller. Make sure I got all the right buttons pushed. Sean, are you with us?
Hey, Rick. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Hi, Sean.
Hey, listen, interesting show this morning. And I, like everybody, have been wrapped up in the election and
good for
sort of
you.
Riding the wave of the finishing. But, Professor, I want to dovetail on something that Rick talked about earlier with the modernizing of the Republican Party, and that is also how the Republicans, the right wing in general, sort of gets their news and how it might have fooled them about the results of the election. There have been several articles out there, and NPR did a really good story a couple of days ago about people who get all their news from Fox News and all their news from conservative radio, who genuinely, truly, honestly believed that Mitt Romney was going to walk away with this election, that it was going to be a landslide, and that if you listen to Fox News, you would hear the pundits get up there and say, oh, yes, he's going to have over 300 electoral votes. He's going to carry all the same states that John McCain did in 2008, plus the swing states. And then when the results didn't go that way, they're actually still shocked.
Yeah.
People are like slack-jawed that their candidate not only didn't win, but well and truly didn't win. And yet, you know, people like Nick Silver of the 538 blog on the New York Times website had been, you know, trending it for months, saying this is the way it's going. And there seemed to be a conflict between facts and numbers and just gut feelings and what they were being told by paid pundits on the conservative media. So do you think now what can the Republican Party and what can the right wing do to, I don't know, just develop a better relationship with reality?
That's a really interesting question. I've been thinking about that, Sean, because I was as a political scientist, I have to watch all the channels on election night, so I was switching across.
I did
switch over to Fox News just as Karl Rove was denying the figures of the people, the numbers crunchers on Fox News regarding Ohio, and said that we should not accept the fact that Ohio has gone for President Obama, and we should certainly wait this out, when the numbers crunchers in Fox News, Sean, were saying it's over. And so I've been quite fascinated by this. I think maybe the lack of reality, as you put it, just put most simply, is due to two factors. One is their extreme hostility to President Obama as president. They just did not accept the fact that he was up to the job. And secondly, and this is connected, they thought the economic fundamentals were so bad for President Obama that he couldn't possibly win the election. And they thought the momentum that seemed to be going their way after the first election was a wave that was going to ride in Governor Romney as president. I think what they failed to grasp, the reality they failed to grasp was something Rick and I have talked quite a bit about, Sean, and I don't know if you agree, but the party was kind of operating as though they were running in the electorate that Ronald Reagan ran in. And it's changed so dramatically, as Rick and I have been talking about. And the other thing that fascinates me, Sean, is that we were talking about how President Obama is kind of in terms represent is there's something pretty modern or about him, and one of the things he's used very effectively is the social media, which is very important to what we call in the biz the ground game, that is getting your supporters out. And I think one of the reasons that President Obama and his organization, Organizing for America, was able to win, what was it, 8 of the 9 toss-up states, everyone but North Carolina, is because they did a better job using the social media to connect with their volunteers on the ground to get their voters out. And I think when you have that many close states falling on the side of one candidate, that shows that their organization was better. And this connects to reality, is that the Republicans were using techniques. They had something called Orca, I think. What's the whale? Named after a whale.
Which is Orca, kind of, Orca the whale.
Which is kind of this more old-fashioned form of the Internet to try to coordinate on Election Day. And they lost their volunteers on the ground. They were confused by this kind of more archaic system. So I think a combination of addressing the demographics, which I think they can do in a principled way, and also really trying to catch up with the very sophisticated campaign organizations that President Obama organized. You know, people made fun of President Obama for being a community organizer. Well, darn it, that's helped him a whole lot as both as president and as a presidential candidate.
Hey, thanks, Sean.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you, Rick. Good show.
Great question.
I got another caller. Just hang tight for a second. But, you know, we were talking about the ground game. If I remember right, and these are just going to be sort of numbers popping into my head.
Yeah,
was it in Ohio... President Obama had over 100 different community groups supporting him on the ground, several of which were the leaders, had been the leaders for 4 years, so that they knew the neighborhood, they knew the people, they knew the area, while Governor Romney's group came in and had one-tenth of that. They had 10 or 12 or 15 different ground organizations, and so they were immediately behind and were unable to catch up, despite what all the news groups were saying.
I think that's a great point. And also, Rick, the Romney campaign invested a lot more in campaign ads and in television ads. Obama, well, certainly, although he made good use of such ads, particularly during the summer, to attack Governor Romney's business background, invested a lot more in the ground game and this very sophisticated, high-information ground game.
11:37 here on the Wake Up Call. Caller, hang with me for just a second. I need to take care of a little business here. Our guest, Professor Sidney Milkus from the White Burkett Miller Professor of Politics and Director of the Democracy and Governance Studies at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. Put that all on your business card.
That takes up half the show, Rick. Why don't you just call me Sid from now on? I think we'll get more callers then.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Market for Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news, on newsstands Thursday. Here's Rick on what you can find on this week's Hook.
Oh, this week, with the purchase of a 200-acre farm, UVA now owns a western wall around Charlottesville, and neighbors want to know what the school has planned. But more massive development be in the future. The battle continues between author Henry Weinseck and other Jefferson historians on Jefferson's treatment of slaves. And there's a special insert from the Area Historical Society looking at the past of Charlottesville and Albemarle through pictures and stories. The Hook, you can handle the truth. And today's programming on WNRN brought to you by Blue Ridge Graphics at Meade Avenue and East High Street here in Charlottesville, providing custom t-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. All right, back in action with our guest, Professor Sidney Milkus. And hopefully, caller, were you that patient with me?
Yes, hello.
Thank you very much for waiting around. You got a question or a comment on our show today?
Yes.
My name is a pimp called the Teflon Tigger, and I do have a question for the good professor. Let me ask you, sir, say this statement rings true. Isn't it true that people's income decides if they live or die within the next 4 years of Obama's tyrannical regime? And what I'm saying is, if somebody has a net income of six figures a year, wouldn't they be more likely to suffer and die under this president's tyrannical iron fist?
All right, Professor. Follow up on that.
Thanks for calling me the good professor. I'm not sure that there was maybe a little sarcasm there. I respectfully want to disagree with the caller that President Obama is tyrannical. I think he is a left of center president, a progressive president. But what he's proposing to do, although it may not be right, I don't think it's going to kill off people with incomes over $250,000 if some kind of deal was worked out and what he's proposing for taxes passes, then that'll raise the income level on those making over $250,000 to 39%. That's a higher rate. It may not be good for the economy. We could argue that. We could argue about whether or not that's a good idea. But I don't think it's the kind of socialism as it's been accused of being that's going to destroy the life of wealthy Americans. What I think does has to happen is that we have to face this fiscal cliff, and that's going to require the Democrats and Republicans work out a compromise. Was the caller's name Tim?
I believe so.
Yeah. There are some Republicans who don't want to compromise at all, and there's some Democrats who don't. I think we've reached stages in our history where we have to work out compromises between the two parties. And, you know, the Republicans didn't lose everything. They still control the House. They control 30 governorships in the country. They still have a lot of power in the country. And I think Democrats and Republicans have to work together to do something about the fiscal cliff. And something along the lines of the Simpson-Bowles Commission has to be worked out, where there's some agreement on how to raise revenue. If it's not in terms of income tax rates, then it has to be – we have to figure out how to close some significant loopholes. And there does probably have to be some entitlement reforms. Entitlements have kind of taken on a life of their own, and probably something does have to be done about Medicare. But with all due respect to the caller, if that's the attitude of the Republican Party, I think that is much more going to be much more destructive for the country than President Obama's tax policies, as he's explained them, are put in place.
11:42 on WNRN. Here, guest today, Professor Sidney Milkus from UVA. Call us with your question or comment, 979-0919. 877-WNRN Rocks. Andy's out there answering the phone. We also want to take a moment and thank the support of Dixon Disposal. Family owned and operated for 40 years, Dixon Disposal works to promote green awareness. Dixon offers all-in-one can recycling, so you won't have to spend time sorting or trying to figure out which items are recyclable. These recyclable items won't end up in the landfill. So for more information on the all-in-one can recycling, it's DixonDisposal.com or call them 978-2111. Professor Milkus, you know, you talk about the Republicans still having the majority of governor roles, still leading in the House, but actually losing two seats, I believe, in the Senate. Re-electing. President Obama. And so the phrase that's been tossed around is it was a status quo election. Hmm. I don't know. I mean, I guess if you look at the big picture in terms of who has this, who has that, that's true. But one of the things that was most interesting to me was how in 2008, the country was swinging far to the Democratic side. In 2010, they started to swing back to the Republican side. In 2012, maybe not quite as big, but a swing back to the Democratic side, if nothing more than reelecting the president, right, who was receiving an enormous amount of negativity for mm-hmm. what had happened during his tenure. Is this some, you know, are there specific incidents that we can point to? Is this just the way our political system has chosen to work in the last 10 to 20 years, our current culture, so to speak? Because I mean, the thing that got me most, caught me most off guard was Elizabeth Warren winning in Massachusetts over, is it Scott Thompson?
Scott Brown.
Yeah. Who was...
How soon we forget, Rick.
Well, that's right. Because all these other numbers are cluttering my head.
Yeah.
But 2 years ago, he was... That was the big win.
Yeah, the special election.
Right,
yeah.
And 2 years later, he loses to the person that I find to believe one of the most liberal candidates in the country. Mm-hmm. Whether that's fair, accurate, or not, that's what I have in my head. Your thoughts on all that I just tossed to you?
That's a lot of stuff you just tossed my way. Well, you know, it's interesting to read the reactions to the election, because and many of my colleagues, even the day after, when we're commenting on the election, you know, we just went through this wrenching contest. We spent all this money, $2 billion, and we're exactly where we were before the election. President Obama is still president. The Democrats control the Senate, and the Republicans control the House. What was that all about? And I think that's the wrong way to look at the election. So I think one really important thing that comes out of this election is that now that President Obama has been reelected, the Republicans, who in part out of political strategy opposed him unequivocally, hoping that he would not be the president in 2013, now have more reason to work with him. And I think that's going to help a whole lot with the...
You couldn't just dig your heels in and wait for him to be turned out.
They could do that, but I think that's, given all the other things we're saying about their worry, that the fact that they're worried about the future, particularly with immigration, I think that could happen, Rick, and I'm not denying it could happen, but I think it's less likely. But I think just in terms of policy, Rick, that one thing that happens as a result of this election is that President Obama's signature policy, the Affordable Care Act, whether you like it or not, will now stay in place because President, I keep calling him President, Rick. Governor, I have to drink more coffee during these breaks.
You obviously watched a lot of Fox News.
I was watching too much Fox News. So Governor Romney said on day one he would start the work of repealing Obamacare, and now that is in place, and the states are going to be, are now scrambling to figure out how to carry that out. I think that alone is a very important part of President Obama's being reelected and the Democrats remaining in control of the Senate. Just a word, Rick, on your notion about the swing of the parties. I think that's a really important phenomenon of contemporary American politics. And it's not completely new. We've had periods in our history before where the people swing back and forth between the parties. And it's usually during times when they're polarized. And there's a lot of rancor characterizes the politics and the American people. You know, it's kind of interesting, Rick. They've kind of gotten more partisan and more involved in this contest, but at the same time, they don't feel perfectly comfortable with it. It's like watching a car wreck, you know, kind of.
Well, you're always fine tuning the radio to get the best, yeah, you know, at least the old timey ones.
Yeah.
You're always trying to find, you always sort of nudge the recipe a little bit this way and a little bit that way to get it just the way you like it.
Yeah. But there's been, you know, when you were talking about 2008 and 2010, that's a pretty, what was there? I forget the seats.
There was a big change.
60 seats and all the governorships. So the changes have been pretty wrenching since 9/11, which sort of added a dimension of partisan rancor to our politics that has not gone away. So I think this is a really important election. It's going to allow President Obama to carry out a signature program. And so the fact that he was able to avoid a swing against him in this election, when, as you've been suggesting throughout the program, a lot of stuff was going against him, I think that's a huge thing to take account of in terms of the results of this campaign.
Well, let me ask you something I should have, you know, gotten more into earlier in the program, 11:48 on the wake-up call. I just saw her walk in for Les Temps Brew. Tomorrow, Winograd will be here at noon for Les Temps. Best of 80s and 90s alternative music. Tomorrow brings out the roots of alternative, because you can't understand where we are without first knowing where we've been. Take a trip back to the times gone by with Les Temps Brew, only here on WNRN. Professor Milkus, the gender gap, as so it's called. I think there was a gender gap, a racial gap, a financial gap.
youth gap, right, generation youth gap.
But
a lot of gaps in America right now.
But the gender gap seemed to be at the top of the discussion list. Yeah. Is there something there that's more than Roe v. Wade that affects the voting outcome for the two parties?
You know, the gender gap is more, professors always say this, more complicated, Rick, than a lot of people have made it out to be. I do think it does relate to Roe v. Wade and issues having to do with abortion, but I also think it has to do with the welfare state policies like the Affordable Care Act. Women, maybe this is because they're more maternalistic, tend to be a little more supportive of programs like health care insurance and unemployment insurance than men do. But the dynamics of the gender gap have more to do with men moving towards the Republican Party, particularly white men, than with women being strongly supportive of the Democratic Party. The gender gap's been created more by the defection of white men to Republicans than by women steadfastly behind the Democratic Party. And also, Rick, you have to take account of the combination between gender and race. So if you just look at white women, a plurality of them voted for Governor Romney. I have to give a shout out to one of my colleagues, Lynn Sanders, who showed me some figures yesterday that suggested if only white women voted in recent American elections, the only Democrat who would have won was Bill Clinton in 1996.
Because he plays a sexy saxophone.
He plays a sexy saxophone. Yeah, we don't want to go there, I don't think.
I mean, that's good to know, I guess, because one of my thoughts that I found to be demeaning was that the only issue that bothered women was the fact that they couldn't have an abortion. And that's how, to me, that's how it's often played out during the discussion, and say that it's not all about Roe v. Wade. There are many more issues that are involved in that, and it's good to know that it's more complex.
It is, yeah. All right. Well, I'm glad. Usually people get annoyed at my complexity, Rick Seifert. But I'll just mention the two states where the women vote was particularly important were Iowa and New Hampshire. Now, there the demographics we've been talking about didn't play out very, very importantly because those are not very diverse states. But there the gender gap, properly understood, was really important in allowing President Obama to win two key swing states.
Professor Sidney Milk is here on the Wake Up Call. And let's see, we got Charlie. Hey, Charlie.
Good morning.
Good morning. A question or a comment?
Yes, just a comment, then wanting a response.
Sure.
I wanted to go back. I know you were talking about gender, but I wanted to go back to one reference to the fiscal cliff.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I know there are a lot of smart people out there that have looked at it, and they're saying that fiscal cliff leads to recession, which reminds me a little bit of some of the Y2K talk. And I was wondering if the professor could comment on the idea that, I know it's draconian, but to me it almost seems like a compromise from the standpoint that it both raises taxes and it cuts spending, which each party, I guess, has different views on, and that maybe it should just happen.
You want to go? You're not risk averse, are you, Charlie? you're willing to go over the cliff?
Pardon?
You think it's worth? You think we should take the risk of allowing the cuts to go into play, and the tax raising?
Okay. Well, like I said, I think there are a lot of smart people out there who studied it. But on the one hand, I think a lot of it'll hurt everyone. But I think it'll hurt. It'll force the government to have some cuts and some. I guess some business practices that many of us out in the business world have already undergone.
Well, you know, Charlie and Professor Milkus, one of the things that I heard recently was that the Democrats had nothing to lose if we went over the cliff because it helped them meet some of their goals of cutting. It cut everything except the entitlement programs. It made the Republicans look bad because they were the ones who didn't come forward and say, "Hey, let's do this." And I don't know if that's true or not, Charlie. I'm gonna let you take Professor's answer off the air, okay?
Hey, Charlie.
Thank you,
Charlie. I have to say, when you were saying what smart people are saying about the fiscal cliff, I am not an economist, so I'm not someone who can comment with a great deal of expertise on this, but I think Rick, I'm not sure it would be good for Democrats because a lot of non-entitlement spending would be cut, which could cause a lot of pain in the country at a time when we're already in a serious we have serious economic problems. I guess, Rick and Charlie, I feel a little uncomfortable about allowing policy to occur automatically. Now maybe we sometimes have to impose draconian, you know, put straitjackets on ourselves to make ourselves behave better. But I think I believe that government is about deliberation and debate and choice. And I think we should have a discussion in the wake of this election and how to interpret it about how best to go forward in terms of our economy. And one thing I would like to see is some reform of the tax system. I don't know about you, Rick, but I do not understand the tax system.
I go back to Governor Jerry Brown from like 25 years ago. He said, everybody pays 13%, slash, yeah. That's it. Do it, yeah. Nice and easy.
So rather than just simply saying we're going to let the Bush tax cuts go out of business and raise the rate on those making more than $250,000, I would like to see some reform, which we underwent in 1986, to plug some of these holes, many of which, Rick, you and I don't even know about, and I think most Americans don't know about it. And if we can close enough of those to have a lower, more uniform tax rate, and that comes out as a fair system for both Democrats and Republicans talking about it, I think that would be a very good thing for the country.
All right, 11:56 here on the Wake Up Call. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. I want to take a moment to thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support of WNRN, celebrating 40 years as your local one-stop source for outdoor gear, apparel, and footwear. You can find fall warmth at Blue Ridge with jackets and vests, sweaters from the North Face, Patagonia, and Mountain Hardware. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is at Barracks Road here in Charlottesville. They have two locations in Richmond. For more information online, it's brms.com. All right, I got a phone call, and I got an anonymous question.
Uh-oh.
Caller, hey, Dewey, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine.
Your question or comment, and then I want to squeeze in time here for a question that was asked offline.
Sure, yeah. I'll be quick. Rick, and yes, the good professor, I think it's very ironic that this president is very much like Clint Eastwood was in that famous movie. I'm not a movie geek. The Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah.
You knew deep down he's a good guy, but man, he carries a big stick.
Yeah.
And I think that was very much present in how he handled himself. I'm very proud of that man, and that's my president. Thank you all.
Well, thank you. And I think we were talking before about how so many Republicans couldn't believe they could lose this election. I think a lot of his opponents underestimated President Obama, and they particularly underestimated what a good organizer and politician that he is. He's extremely, you know, his rhetorical gifts are great, but he's also a very smart, savvy politician. You need both those things to succeed in American politics.
As many of us were reminded in the last several days, is he's a community activist.
He's a community activist. And I don't know if you saw, Rick, it went viral on YouTube, his speech to his the leaders.
Where he tears up.
Tears up. I mean, there you saw how much he cares about these people who have his back politically.
All right, here's a question that came in by phone, and I'm quoting, "Now that reelection isn't an issue, do you know how marijuana is going to be regulated on a federal level? Will any strides be made to legalize and gain revenue?"
We would end the show on marijuana, wouldn't we, Rick? Well, it's been legalized in a couple of states, right? Colorado.
That's right. Colorado, yeah. And Washington, I believe.
Yeah. Although I think, what was it? My wife was telling me there's already been a comment from the governor of Colorado. Don't get too excited. Don't get goldfish out yet.
Right. Don't break out the
Cheetos
and goldfish.
Rules.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I love that.
Right. I love that as well. So, I suppose it's really hard to tell what's a trend and what's an aberration and is not going to spread. But I suspect that what went on in Colorado and Washington is you know, probably suggests something about the future of the country. Again, it's the we have this cultural battle going on connected to substantial demographic changes in the country. I don't think marijuana is the leading issue, but it's another thing to look at in terms of what people really about what the kind of values that the country's under the change in values the country's undergone in the last couple of decades.
Well, and the conversation even in the last week has been, no, we won't raise taxes, but yes, we do need to find more ways of revenue.
Yeah, yeah. And, and that may be
that could be one.
Maybe they've visited Colorado and they're smoking too much dope, Rick. But I do think there's plenty of reform to be done there. But I think without that'll have to be combined with some interest rate adjustment as well. So I agree with your premise of your comment.
All right.
Is that the first time we've agreed in this hour?
No. Mm-hmm. It's been a wonderful hour. Thank you so much
really
for coming on.
Rick. And thanks to the callers.
Yes, thank you very much. WNRN Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Our guest today, UVA's Professor Sidney Milkus. Next week, we'll be talking about filmmaking in Virginia. The goal to have an actor, a possible director, and someone from the state to talk about how you market filmmaking and get those filmmakers here. Please join us next Sunday. Next up, Tomorrow Winograd with Les Timms Perdue.
This has been your Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on WNRN. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news. On newsstands Thursday, The Wake Up Call is also supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com.